Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Today we'll talk with Greg Grandin about the real history behind Herman Melville's great novella Benito Sereno, and with Melissa Jira Grant about sex work as work. In a previous life, I was a budding literary type, English major in college, 3 years in graduate English. I started to write a dissertation and then gave it all up for journalism. Herman Melville was one of my icons in those days. It was wonderful to have an excuse to read him again, which is something I haven't done in years. The excuse was the historian Greg Grandin's new book, Empire of Necessity, from Metropolitan Books, which is about the real history behind Melville's marvelous novella, Benito Sereno. Sometimes I feel like a world of 140-character tweets is reading my intellect, so it's extremely therapeutic, not to mention moving, to read this story in which not much happens for page after page, except Melville's masterful evocation of uncertainty and dread. And although it's well known that the story is, as we say today, fact-based, no one ever looked as deeply into its history, which is really a history of how this hemisphere was so profoundly shaped by slavery, as Greg Grandin does. When he's not writing wonderful books, Greg teaches Latin American history at NYU. Greg Grandin. Welcome, Greg. So how'd you get into this book? You read the Melville story?
I did read the Melville story. I read it about 6 years ago. Actually, it was recommended to me by Corey Robin, somebody who's been on your show, and just for a class that I was teaching on U.S. Latin American relations and kind of as a fictional illustration of at Anglo and Spanish relations and stereotypes as mediated through slavery, and then I learned that it was a true story, and I just got deeper and deeper in trying to unravel it.
Give a synopsis for people who haven't read the story or haven't read it recently.
Yeah, the Melville story is really a remarkable novella. It was written a few years after Moby Dick and a few years before the Civil War. It really captures a sense, a feeling of antebellum despair that Melville and many other people, I guess, felt at the moment. It's about a New England sea captain from Duxbury, Massachusetts, who finds himself in the South Pacific. And he comes across a distressed Spanish slave ship. He boards this ship and he spends all day on board, and most of it by himself. Basically, he sends his crew away to fetch water and food. Thinks he's on a regular slave ship, a battered but functioning slave ship, and he becomes increasingly obsessed with the relationship between the Spanish captain, Benito Sereno, title of the story, and his loyal, or apparently loyal, black body servant, Babo. Most of the action takes place in Delano's mind. It's a very claustrophobic, compressed story. And Melville tells the story through Delano's perspective, point of view. And it's revealed about two-thirds in that the West Africans aren't slaves, that they're rebels, that they had only been pretending to be slaves. They had risen up, seized the ship. And when they came across Delano's vessel, they had two choices. They could have fought or fled, but instead they came up with this remarkable deception. And what's great about the story is more the style. It's that Melville really keeps it in Delano's head. It's like a gothic story on the high seas in the South Pacific.
Well, yeah, it's like scores and scores of pages of just mood setting and scene setting, and very psychologically rich, but not an awful lot happens.
No, and it's it's great to contrast with Moby Dick, right? Moby Dick is this sprawling, capacious story that takes place in multiple oceans with crews of all men of all races in the crew. And even though it's catastrophic what happens, it's kind of a joyous story in many ways. But Benito Sereno really is just compressed, and it's, I guess, nominally set on the slave ship, but it really takes place in Delano's mind, where nothing much happens except his obsessions and his fantasies. And Melville has these wonderful passages of him imagining what it would be like to be waited on by Babo. He shows Babo holding up an increasingly vacant and broken Benito Sereno, wiping the spittle from his mouth, shaving him. And through, of course, Babo is the orchestrator, the curator of this whole pantomime of the master-slave relation, and Delano really can't see what's in front of his face.
Well, he is the classic American innocent abroad in some sense, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's could be considered the first of the fully realized, direct heir to the quiet American. And people have, literary scholars have read him as that kind of a avatar of American innocence or virtue that that can't connect cause to effect.
Melville's politics are around slavery, as with much of Melville's view of the world. It's fraught with ambivalence, right? It's really very hard to classify him in any kind of taxonomy we'd recognize today.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly believed in emancipation, and he clearly was opposed to slavery. Some of his writings before Benito Cereno dealt with slavery in either in allegorical or real terms, and he was obviously opposed to it. He definitely wasn't an abolitionist, though. He believed abolitionists or the transcendentalists and the Christian reformers were too sentimental, too naive. He equated them often with the Jacobins or the French Revolution. I think a good way to think of Melville is situate Melville. Melville's position towards slavery was kind of like Camus' relationship to colonialism. He was opposed to it, but he believed the fight against it might prove more destructive than the solution was worth. So he kind of was trapped in an impasse of his own making in some ways. He felt that the United States confronted two choices. One, it could fight to end slavery, and that could very well destroy the republic, destroy the experiment in liberty, or it could leave slavery alone and admit that freedom for some required slavery for others. And, you know, other people, preservationists, faced this dilemma, but they were easily reconciled to the idea of maintaining slavery in order to maintain the Union. Melville, I think, really was paralyzed by the dilemma.
Yeah, he was just perpetually troubled, it seems.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Now, you're a historian, not a literary critic, so what drew you into this investigation then?
When I was teaching the class that I assigned the book, I was actually doing some background reading to prepare for the class. I was reading a great book, Michael Rogan, Subversive Genealogy, a Political Theorist, and that book does a nice comparison between Marx and Melville. It makes the case that Herman Melville is an American Karl Marx, the contemporaneous, and they wrestled with many of the same contradictions of bourgeois society. And he had a footnote saying that Benito Cereno was a true story, and I remember staring at that footnote for quite a while. It was kind of like hearing that Ridley Scott's Alien was a true story or something, because the structure is the same, right? You're on board a ship and there's something evil is lurking on board, but you don't know who or what, and then it's revealed in an explosive manner about two-thirds into the story. But even more so, considering how could this group of West Africans pull off such a deception on an experienced mariner? Thanks to the wonders of Google Books, the memoir that Melville gets the story from, Massa Delano, is all online, a full PDF version. It's a fascinating read, and I don't think Melville was just attracted to Chapter 18, where Delano, the historical Delano, tells the story of this deception. You know, Delano wrote it as he means it to. He says, "I want to add to the store of knowledge," but the whole memoir is the impossibility of knowing anything. He just bounces from one deceit and delusion and fiasco to another. Even though he is created by the American Revolution, he is catapulted by the American Revolution into world history. This is the historical Delano I'm talking about. Now, he witnesses many of the historic events that we think of as creating modern times. He's in India. He's in South Africa. He's in the Galapagos before Darwin is. He crosses paths with the French Revolution and Jacobins in the Indian Ocean. But he can't quite make good on the promise of the American Revolution. I call him a Republican zealot in the book. He's almost a testament to the impossibility of doing anything with knowledge. He had a deep faith that the world was transparent, the world was knowable, and that individuals can govern their emotions and their passions, and extrapolated from that Republican society could be founded on laws and transparent institutions. But his whole book is a testament to the impossibility of that. And so that book, after reading that memoir, I got drawn in deeper and deeper and just began to research the event itself that inspired Melville.
Yeah, and the early days of American Republicanism were also, despite its allegiance to reason and law, were founded on incredible violence of whaling, sealing, and, of course, slavery, the founding violent crime of the country.
Yeah, and it's all in Delano's life. I mean, his uncle was involved in the French-American War. He was involved in raiding an Indian village up the Connecticut Valley, and then burning it to the ground and massacring hundreds of people. But then this British militia got lost on the way down, and they wound up having to cannibalize their Native American captives that they took from this village, basically eating them alive. I mean, killing them, cooking them and eating them. And then they were massacred the next day in revenge. So even in Delano's own family history, and he's named after this Uncle Amasa, you see these founding violence of, violence and then genocidal violence and then retribution and then violence, the retribution and revenge and blowback, all within his own family, who, by the way, was an ancestor of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah, and parenthetically, you also write a bit about a Jacobin slaver, the French Revolution also, trading slaves.
So basically, the book tells two stories. One, it follows Amasa Delano out of Duxbury and around the world and into the Pacific. And then the other story, it traces the West Africans out of West Africa, across the Atlantic, across the Americas, and into the Pacific. And the way they wound up in Montevideo, sister city from Buenos Aires and Rio de la Plata in southern South America, Spanish America, was they were actually bound for the Caribbean on a Liverpool slaver. But in 1804, it was intercepted by a French revolutionary pirate, Hippolyto Morday, who actually, believe it or not, only had one arm. I joked around about this also, that I never knew how much I wanted to start a book with a one-armed French pirate until I actually did start a book with a one-armed French pirate. But he was on this itinerary, on this journey of the West Africans across the world. They'd meet many of these men of the Age of Liberty, in this particular case, a Jacobin, who was a partisan of the French Revolution and an adherent of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And yet he made his living seizing British cargo and bringing it to Buenos Aires and Montevideo, and the most lucrative cargo by far were African slaves.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, author of Empire of Necessity, just out from Metropolitan Books. It's easy for U.S. Americans to think of slavery as primarily a business of this country, but it was really the whole hemisphere was deeply involved in the slave trade.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, this is not any great innovation on my part. I just tried to kind of sew it all together in this narrative. But, when people in the U.S. think of slavery, they think of 12 years a slave. They think of the violence and explosion of chattel slavery that happened in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s in the United States after the West is open, the Mississippi bottomlands are open, the War of 1812, the invention of the cotton gin. But what happens in the U.S. really is the last phase of a much broader phenomenon, of a much more dispersed explosion starting in the Caribbean in the 1770s, moving down to Brazil and Spanish America, and then reaching the United States. The Spaniards really did respond with every burst of revolutionary ardor, whether it be the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the execution of Louis and Marie Antoinette in France, with what we would call privatization and deregulation of the slave trade. Slavery existed in Spanish America for centuries, but it was tightly regulated. But beginning with the Age of Liberty, the Age of Revolution, Spain began to open up the number of ports that slaves could be brought into. They began to lower tariffs and taxes. They began to allow more and more people to own ships and sail straight to Africa and bring back enslaved peoples. The Spaniards, they didn't mince any words in describing what this was. They called it free trade in blacks.
And of course, as Marx said, that's the most important freedom of all, right?
Yeah, this contradiction. If one's freedom is the freedom to own property, what do you do with people who are understood to be property? And, all of this stuff happens in the shadow of the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian independence. So, and you think of Haiti as exploding that contradiction, right? But for many Spanish American merchants, more liberty, más libertad, meant more liberty to own people.
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes that run throughout the book is this contradiction between the Age of Enlightenment, talking about individual freedom and self-development, at the same time it rested on a trade in human beings.
Yeah, Now, other people have talked about this, that capitalism is this massive project of ego formation, the way individual preferences, individual rights, a sense of interiority are kind of dispersed throughout the population as a result of the commodification of relations, social relations, and the prosperity that generalizes privileges that have been assigned only to the gentry and aristocracy. I guess what I'm trying to do is show the importance of slavery in that, in all sorts of ways, right? The ways in which ideals of individual interests and self-creation are understood in metaphorical terms as the master-slave relationship. The, you know, slaves as being the impulses and the passions that need to be controlled by a higher order of virtue or reason or discipline. And I think that this deception at the heart of the story that I'm telling kind of gets at the, you know, gets at that.
Yeah, I mean, if you have somebody like John Calhoun, you know, he could frankly embrace the slavery of some as the condition of possibility of the civilization of others. But for, you know, a lot of other Americans who are not so consciously pro-slavery, it tied him up into knots.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's great about Calhoun, right? Because he renders, he overt what other people, you know, are not fully conscious of. I mean, there's lots of ways in which slavery makes possible and defines freedom, just in terms of the material wealth that it creates and the psychic relations that we're talking about. You know, but the numbers are quite striking, right? I mean, you know, so historians think that about 12.5 million Africans were taken out of Africa and brought to America. They have statistics on about over 10 million of those in terms of ship inventories and whatnot. More than half, more than 5 million, came to America after July 4th, 1776. So, I mean, very graphic ways, the age of liberty was the age of slavery, right? I mean, you know, we can talk about the how that happens in abstract terms, but just in terms of raw numbers, I mean, you see the way that slavery makes freedom possible.
And also made possible the prosperity of New England and New York City.
Yeah, these are old arguments. Eric Williams, Sidney Mintz, Lorenzo Green, these wonderful historians that have been emphasizing the important economic importance of slavery, not just the profits that the cotton that was picked or the cane was cut, but just the way money and finance from slavery underwrote all of the major institutions of wealth that today dominate the U.S. economy, finance, insurance, real estate. Aetna wrote some of its first policies on slave voyages. Brooks Brothers Clothing Emporium got its start selling coarse slave clothing to plantations.
I just happen to be wearing a Brooks Brothers shirt.
No, there you go.
Every, what do they know?
Every document of civilization.
One of the things that's so interesting about Melville's story is the way he plays with our sympathies. I mean, this sense of evil is brought about by identification with the master and not with the rebels against their slavery. It creates that strange psychological landscape. But the slaves had done something on the ship that they were thought not capable of. They concocted a complex plot and managed to pull it off.
Yeah, and you know, the historical, the fixed, I mean, Melville gets all of this from the true story. It's, you know, it was unbelievably audacious and in remarkable conditions. They were starving, they were thirsty. They had risen up about 50 something days earlier, and they were out of food, they were out of water. Two women and two infant children had died of dehydration. And yes, that's exactly what they did. They managed to summon up, despite all of this, they managed to summon inner resources and kind of shed the trappings of freedom and assume this pantomime of slavery, which both in the historical case and in Melville's retelling, I think gets at the fundamental deception of slavery, that slaves had no cunning, they had no interior life, they had, you know, what you saw on the inside was what there was on the outside. So these West Africans used the resources that they were said not to possess, guile, reason, discipline, to give the lie to the things that they were said to be, loyal, simple-minded, transparent. I mean, you know, in terms of Melville, if you just contrast it with Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin was this international bestseller. Millions of copies of books were sold in the early 50s. And, you know, Beecher Stowe was a Christian reformer. She was opposed to slavery. And she made her case for abolition on presenting Africans and African Americans in plantations as being transparent, as being purer Christians, as having a kind of Christ-like innocence. So Melville writes the story a few years later that, of course, doesn't sell and nobody knows about until the 1920s, really, which portrays West Africans as the exact opposite, as cunning, as deceitful, as brutal. I mean, there's intimations in the story that they cannibalize the slaver that they kill that was bringing them to Lima. And this is, I think, a very strong case for Melville recognizing the humanity of the West Africans and by attributing the brutality to them.
And then Babo's head ends up on a stick, which is not the way it happened in reality, right? But there's a line about the buzzing hide of his head.
Yeah. Literary scholars debated throughout the 20th century what Melville meant by this, because he left really, this goes back to this earlier discussion that we had, and left no diary or no letters saying why he wrote the story or why he basically rewrote chapter 18 of Amasa Delano's memoir. Well, for a while, literary scholars read it as not about slavery. They read it about some cosmic struggle between virtue and evil, or innocence and evil. It wasn't until really the 1950s and 60s with the civil rights movement and Black Power movement that scholars began to really say that this is actually really about slavery. And one of the things they focused on for making the case why Melville was actually sympathetic to the West Africans, despite portraying them as brutal and vengeful, is the very end of the story ends with a broken Benito Sereno in a monastery about to die of trauma. And the head of Babo, the rebel leader, across the plaza, on a spike, you know, unabashedly gazing, meeting the gaze of the whites. And Melville says it was his head, not his body, that planned the revolt. You know, he called it a hive of subtlety. So again, attributing this intense intelligence and humanity to the leader of this rebellion.
And also the slaves themselves had heard a lot and acted upon all the talk that was floating around about liberty, egalite, and fraternity.
Yeah, undoubtedly, especially those West Africans that were brought in on that by that one-armed French pirate. 1803 was the year that Haiti drove Napoleon's troops out of Haiti when they were trying to reestablish slavery on that island and sugar slavery on that island. 1804, they declared independence. And one of the things that's fascinating about the historical event is, after the rebellion, after they rose up and seized the ship, one of the places they wanted to be taken to was, quote, a land of blacks that they heard exist in these waters. You know, that in itself is fascinating, but you know, for a long time, the importance of Haiti was ignored by scholars, so much so that a famous anthropologist, historical anthropologist, Michel Rouffetriault, wrote a wonderful book called Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History, about the way Haiti is ridden out of the Age of Liberty, histories of the Age of Liberty, the Age of Revolution. And so Benito Sereno's response to this request to be taken to a land of blacks that they heard exist in these waters is to say, no such land exists. I mean, it's as powerful an illustration of the denial of Haiti and the reality of what Haiti represents as one could imagine.
And finally, you draw a contrast between what happened with slavery in Latin America and what happened in the United States. The liberation of slaves was part of the liberation, the national liberation movements in Latin America, and not here, right?
Yeah, I mean, the chronology gets very complicated, and there's different moments of emancipation and of abolition in Latin America. But certainly by the 1850s, and certainly by the Civil War, slavery is pretty much over in Latin America, Spanish America, not in Brazil. It goes on to 1880s in Brazil, but it's really much more advanced in terms of granting nominal rights to Africans in Latin America. I mean, part of it is, I do try to come back and do this almost covert comparison with the after effects of the racism born in slavery. And that's where the title comes in, Empire of Necessity. Melville has this great epigraph for another short story called that runs Seeking to Conquer a Larger Liberty, Man But Extends the Empire of Necessity. Scholars think Melville basically wrote that. He assigns it. He says he got it from an unpublished manuscript in his possession. It's an epigraph he uses, but Melville scholars think that he just wrote that himself. And it's a wonderfully Hegelian phrase. And I read it as indicating Melville was uncomfortable with the fetish of individual supremacy and freedom that took hold in the United States. And I think that what he was getting at there was not so much that the contradiction or the paradox between freedom and slavery was a problem, but the denial of the paradox, the way that one could believe that one wasn't involved in the master-slave relation, the way that kind of skipping off, fleeing forward into the West or into the Pacific allowed one to think that, you know, they could just embrace this larger empire of liberty and not have any of the responsibilities or obligations that come with just being human and living in a social world. And I guess a covert comparison, a covert argument of the book is that Latin Americans recognize the empire of necessity, and that accounts for their ongoing embrace of social democracy and social rights. And in the United States, there's this much more stringent liberalism, negative rights, liberal democracy that has taken hold that really is unique in the world in some ways. And I think a lot of it actually comes out of the particular histories of slavery in the Americas and in the United States in particular.
That was Greg Grandin, professor of history at NYU and author of Empire of Necessity, just out from Metropolitan Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 11, performed by Alfred Brendel. And from slavery to sex work, and this is not the place where you're going to hear any parallels drawn between the two practices. Melissa Jarrett Grant has a terrific new book out called Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, one of the first three titles in a new series of elegant little books Verso is putting out in partnership with Jacobin Magazine. No, sex workers do not want your pity, and they do not want to be rescued by Nicholas Kristof. Here's Melissa Jarrett Grant to tell us why.
Let's talk a little bit about language. The words for women who sell sex have changed over the years. We've had, you know, ladies of the night, fille de joie, but then whore, tramp, and now sex worker. What's the meaning to you of the evolution of the language around this kind of work?
I think it speaks to this idea that, you know, for a time there wasn't a person who had the identity of someone who sold sex. Like, these words used to refer to somebody who maybe was a social outcast, but it didn't necessarily refer to somebody who, like, this was what they thought of as their occupation or their job, which is why sex worker feels quite different, right? Like, sex work is a term that sex workers themselves invented to describe themselves versus something like prostitute, which is mostly thought of as a demeaning word, but more than that, it's a word imposed upon people who sell sex by people who don't to describe what they do. So for me, what this shift means and why the term sex work is so important is it speaks to the idea that this is an activity that people do. It's not necessarily like a social outcast role that they're going to be identified with for the rest of their lives. Even if they might, you know, enjoy or take power out of identifying as a sex worker, that might be gratifying for them as an identity, that it doesn't describe everything that they are and everything that they do. It just talks about this one part of their life that is a job like any other job.
And this, of course, is partly capitalism, which defines us by our occupational role, and partly moralism around sex. And both these things together, powerful.
Right, and a fear that, like, this is the thing that people do when other jobs fail them. Like, I think that that's the myth that, you know, this word prostitute sort of holds up. Like, even people who think of themselves as maybe quite progressive on issues will still say things like, oh, I would never prostitute myself to that, or I would never whore myself out to that. Like, the idea that, like, there's this special transaction that means that you're especially selling yourself out if you participate in it. And I think if you can kind of brush that away and say, actually, no, like, everybody is engaging in some form of labor in order to survive, and this is just a particularly stigmatized form of labor because, as you said, it's about sex.
I was actually called a whore on Twitter just the other day because I had an interview with someone who was favorable to the Venezuelan revolution. So it happens to all of us.
There's whores everywhere if you just look around, I guess.
And I must do penance for having committed an error in my first question by saying women who sell sex, which, of course, women do sell sex, but so do men.
But I think it's an important distinction to say, like, that these words and this social baggage and this cultural opprobrium is really reserved for women who sell sex. Sometimes maybe trans women who sell sex, when you think about kind of the stereotypes of trans women who sell sex and every terrible, you know, quote-unquote tranny hooker joke, which is like, you know, that itself is a slur. But they don't tend to talk about men who sell sex that way. And I think that that draws attention to this as a particularly gendered insult and a particularly gendered concern that, you know, no one is going off to rescue men who sell sex in quite the same way that they attempt to rescue women who sell sex.
The rescue industry, of course, is very busy and growing rapidly, it seems, with CEO Nick Kristof in the front. What precisely are the women they rescue being rescued from in their imagination?
I think that if you really sat down with them and asked them about it, they would really be focused on the sexual transaction, right? Like, that's certainly what the more kind of sensationalist writing that the rescue industry produces about itself will tell you, that, you know, sex work for them is perceived to be as a form of commercial rape, which is what Rishira Gupta from the NGO Apnea App, which I talk about a bit in the book, describes sex work as. Gloria Steinem has also described sex work in the same way as this commercial rape. So they don't believe that this can actually be work. Like, they believe that this is some kind of pseudo-economic system where women who have no other choices are engaging in stuff that could never be consensual. And so as far as they're concerned, if we can just stop you from exchanging sex for money, then we are ending the most dangerous thing that you're facing in your life. We are removing you from the most terrible situation that you're in. But the reality is they can't actually remove those women, and it's usually women that they're looking after and want to take care of and protect. They can't remove them from the larger social and economic position in which they live in. They can't entirely remove them from the forces of poverty and globalization that make sex work an option that is more favorable for them than other options that they might have. It might be like the last choice that they ever want to make in terms of what they have to do to survive, but among other more miserable choices, they still have a power to choose. So I find it sort of troubling that this is, you know, a project, this rescue kind of, these projects are described as women's rights or even economic empowerment projects, but they're premised on this idea that if you're selling sex, that could never be a choice. And so they're defining for these women what this area of their life is. They're saying all of this for you was rape. If you want our help, then, and this is one of the more toxic parts of these projects, if you want our help, then you must understand the commercial sex you engaged in and the way that we understand it. For the most part, women who run these projects have never sold sex. So who are they to define for other women what that experience was, particularly as a condition of getting help?
Yeah, the women are always, it seems, mute. I don't hear Nick Kristof interviewing the women he's rescued.
I think he has, but I think, you know, I'd still question, like, who he chooses to interview, particularly in his Half the Sky project, which is, you know, his new branded platform of economic empowerment. I think the tagline on that is from oppression to opportunity. So the thrust of the entire thing is we're taking you out of, you know, this terrible situation, and we're going to empower you through telling your story. But the only way you can tell your story to the world, of course, is through Nick Kristof. So even when he is speaking to people who've had these experiences, he's choosing who he's talking to. He's framing it in the way that he wants to frame it. And he only has access to the people that the NGOs he partners with bring him to. He doesn't necessarily have access to people with experiences that are going to contradict the rescue narrative, because they probably don't want to talk to him, to be honest.
And what happens, well, a lot of focus on Cambodia, a favorite target of Kristof et al., which is also a major garment producer, which you know, raises two questions. One is that no one ever talks about women being forced into the garment industry. They were only forced into sex, selling sex. But then if they're rescued to what? Working in the garment industry or what?
This is something that, Anne Elizabeth Moore, the journalist who you've had on your show before, and I are talking a lot about, like the relationship between the sex industry in Cambodia and the garment industry, and the conduit in the middle being these rescue projects. So what some of these rescue projects will say is, we're going to take women who are forced into sex work, and you know, by that they mean doing sex work at all, because they believe it's all forced. We're going to take them and we're going to retrain them for decent work making garments. And sometimes it goes even a step further. The garment work that they are doing, those garments are sold to make money for the rescue project, to rescue more people, to make more garments. The whole like labor chain there raises some really big questions for me around, well, wait a minute, now you actually have to provide this pool of laborers to keep this project going. Like, aren't you now creating another potentially destructive economic system in this community? And it also ignores the fact that the Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Workers, who are one of the more organized networks of small grassroots sex worker projects in that region, they reported that a lot of their members already did garment work and had left the garment work that they were doing in order to do sex work because the wages were higher and they had more control over their time. So this assumption that, anyone in sex work is like an unskilled laborer who's unfit for decent work, it's not actually the reality for everybody who's doing sex work.
In these narratives, sex work becomes this unitary thing. There's no variety in this world. Women are all, and again...
We can talk about women. It's okay.
Yeah. I just want to make it clear it's not only women, but in this case they're the stars of the show.
Mm-hmm.
They're trafficked into it. They're forced into it. They have no agency. They make no decisions on their own. And they must be liberated as downtrodden victims.
Yeah,
this, of course, is very much at odds with truth.
The rescue project, I think, the more that I looked at them and researched them and got to do some reporting on them up close, they seem to resemble the same narratives about prostitution that we have as a culture. The same stigmatizing, universalizing narratives that anybody in prostitution, anybody who's ever been involved in any kind of commercial sex has no choices, that this is absolutely, you know, the lowest a person can go. And you see those same narratives employed by these projects that claim to be providing empowerment, that claim to be offering an alternative, that claim to be, you know, looking at these women in a more holistic or caring way. And I question the extent that they can do that when they're still propping up what I think are very deeply misogynist, in some cases very racist, narratives about women, women's worth, women's value. So, I think that they actually fit quite seamlessly in with the very stigmatizing narrative about sex work that almost all of us are raised in. And, you know, then when they try to say that they're offering something different for women, but contingent on that something different is embracing your own victimhood and not having any space to talk about choices that you've made or agency that you have in your life, you know, that doesn't sound like empowerment.
Yeah, and if they actually listened to what sex workers want, it would be not being harassed by cops, not being beaten up or robbed by clients. I mean, there's the real safety issues that they're concerned with as workers, but those concerns do not appear in the rescue narrative.
Right. The rescue narrative, when it comes across, you know, these labor concerns that sex workers have, or concerns about interactions with law enforcement, which I would say are also labor concerns, because when you rely on criminalization to regulate sex work, you're essentially handing the regulator role over to police. The police, in a sense, become your boss. And when folks who are coming from this kind of rescue place hear really valid concerns the sex workers have about safety and violence, they sometimes aren't able to separate that out and hear that this is a violent thing that happened to me in the course of my work, not my job is violent and therefore the solution is to remove me from it. And that's where the empowerment project sort of, I think, really veer most off course from sex workers' own projects, which sex workers' rights projects are saying, no matter what I'm doing for a living, I have a right to do it free from harm. And I shouldn't have to defend the existence of the sex industry in order to have rights at work and to be free from violence. And the rescue projects are saying, first we're going to remove you from sex work, and then we'll just take it from there. Like, there's no room in the rescue project narrative for workers' rights. There's no room there for sex workers' empowerment on their own terms so long as they continue to do sex work.
And you know, this underscores the point that sex work is work and has all the problems associated with work itself.
Right. And, you know, particularly sex work, the focus of my book is on the United States and looking at how the sex industry is sort of, you know, some people would say it's like mainstreaming and normalizing, that it's like, you know, trying to pass itself off as just job like any other. But I think what's actually happening is the service industry is also sort of colliding into sex work in ways. And there are jobs in the service industry that require service workers to produce ever more kind of personalized and intimate experiences for their customers. That sometimes, you know, when you're talking about a high-end spa, when you're talking about massage services, when you're talking about, you know, very specialized kinds of coaching and practices like that that are very intimate, like, it starts to resemble forms of sex work. Like, I think the lines are blurring on both sides. When we talk about the kinds of work that people are doing and how that is putting them in ever more precarious economic positions. You know, more and more people are expected to be their own boss, which is certainly the case for many freelance sex workers. Like, you know, there are people in the sex industry who have jobs in more formalized workplaces like strip clubs or working in porn, but the vast majority of people are working independently. And that's something that is going to be difficult for any worker. That's going to be something that requires you to continue to manage relationships with all your different employers, to have to carry the burdens of your own work expenses. You know, that's common to lots of different workers' experience. But when you focus just on the sex part, you tend to miss that. You know, how common the issues that many sex workers face are common across lots of different kinds of independent and service work.
I'm speaking with Melissa Jarrah Grant, who's the author of Playing the Whore from Verso, one of the three premier titles in the Jacobin series they're doing. There's a phrase you quote from, I believe, Elizabeth Bernstein, carceral feminism, which is in a very unholy alliance with the police and, in some ways, the moralizing right. Talk about what the evolution in the attitude towards prostitution and sex work within American feminism in the last 30 or so years. It's changed rather dramatically, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, when I was able to go back and look at some of the material coming out of feminist groups in the 70s, as they were kind of, you know, the mainstream of feminist movement as it was looking at lots of issues, it was like, well, what's our take on sex work or prostitution going to be? And it was really different in the 70s than it is in this moment. You know, I think that there was a lot more space in the United States anyway, in feminist organizing for more grassroots projects, for projects that were like run by and for the people that they were meant to actually help. There was, like, you know, for lack of a better word, a lot more of a do-it-yourself kind of spirit in feminism. And the 80s brought a kind of formalization and institutionalization of some feminist projects. So use an example outside of sex work, but somewhat related. You know, I worked in a rape crisis center in college, and I was shocked to find out that, like, we were getting all this funding from the Department of Justice. I thought, that was strange. Why, you know, like, what do we do all day? You know, we have peer-based groups where survivors of violence can talk to each other about the kinds of violence they've experienced. We run a crisis hotline. We do educational classes in the community about gender-based violence. Like, why does the Department of Justice want to fund that? And it's because the paradigm for gender-based violence and sexual assault at that point was a law and order paradigm. Like, this is a criminal justice issue, and what we have to do is identify perpetrators and charge them. But that's not necessarily, you know, a feminist paradigm. But I think there was a moment where, you know, particularly like in the anti-violence movement, people thought, oh, well, we can get all of this government funding to do the work that we're doing, and we're just going to, like, reframe the issue, right? But we'll still be about empowering women. We're just going to, you know, adopt this kind of law and order paradigm insofar as it helps us get money.
Well, I remember the early 80s when Andrea Dworkin was working with Ed Meese on pornography.
Right. You know, that the Meese Commission was able to make these recommendations that the previous porn commission, I think under Nixon, actually said, nope, we don't see a causal relationship between porn and violence. And then Reagan has this replay. And again, like, Dworkin and also Catherine McKinnon, who's, you know, a lawyer, their solutions were, we need more laws. That's how we're going to reduce the harm of pornography that they believed led to violence against women. You know, regardless, even if, like, the studies that they were looking at didn't actually show this harm, that didn't matter to them. Like, they wanted to send a message through passing tough laws about porn. And that idea that, you know, we can protect, in this case, women from violence by passing tough laws and sending a message. Like, you see that same paradigm in violence against women. You see that same paradigm around sex work. And the reality is, and why Bernstein calls this carceral feminism, is, you know, it's this faith in this arm of the state that traditionally actually is quite operated against women's interests. And, you know, even to this day, like, look at what's going on right now with Marissa Alexander in Florida, where, you know, over the weekend we found out that her 20-year sentence, which she got for firing a warning shot in the air when her abusive partner came to assault her, that now she's actually facing 60 years for this.
Maybe if the part had been playing loud music, it would have been okay.
Right. You know, if she were George Zimmerman, she would have been acquitted, right? This is the state apparatus that we're going to ally ourselves with to protect women in sex work that can't even distinguish between someone who's a survivor of violence defending themselves and somebody who's actually a violent criminal. So that, I think, is something that cuts across lots of different issues and concerns in feminism right now, and I find so clarifying to think about, okay, well, what does this alliance with the police say? Like, why are we all of a sudden...
Why did it happen? Because, you know, we think back in the 70s feminism, it was anti-authoritarian and anti-patriarchal, and police are symbols of patriarchal authority in many ways. Like, why did this, what seems like a very unlikely alliance, come to be?
And the feminism that I grew up in, you know, it was more tangential to kind of like gay rights and struggles around AIDS, where, you know, in all of the ACT UP and Stonewall iconography I grew up on, like, the police were the people who were standing
up
opposite, right? Like, so to all of a sudden now be in this sort of relationship where you're being told, you know, it comes up too with clinic escorts and abortion clinics who are in a position of having to call the police to protect themselves from the activists, the anti-choice, you know, harassers who are there to prevent people from coming in and getting an abortion, you know, and they're like, wait a minute, now we're having to rely on the police to protect us, like. I think it's an issue that, like, comes up across the movement. But around sex work, because I think we don't really have another paradigm for thinking about sex work except as a criminal issue, and we can't think of it as a labor issue, we can't think of it as a rights issue, then it's that much easier for people to get in bed with the police and believe that, you know, like, it's almost like we can't imagine prostitution without police involvement.
Well, now, there's also been a shift from treating, you know, in some circles, treating the sex worker as a criminal, to treating the sex worker as a victim and the purchaser of sex work, sexual services, as the criminal. So now it's bust the Johns, go after the men. What do you make of that?
I mean, it sounds like a fantasy, to be honest, like a fantasy of how policing could work. And why I say it's a fantasy isn't, you know, an opinion. Like, this is based on looking still at who gets arrested in this kind of arrangement. So, you know, most recently in New York in the lead up to the Super Bowl, the police were messaging to the press, we're going to go after the buyers, we're going to go after the pimps who are bringing women in for the Super Bowl, which of course didn't actually pan out.
There's never any factual basis for these hysteria.
No. And so now, you know, so what they'll say is, okay, well, we're going to go after the buyers, we're going to go after, and then we're going to treat the sellers, the women, as victims and not criminals. But that still doesn't prevent them from arresting people, detaining people, putting them through the criminal legal system, giving them charges that they did not have before that moment. You know, it doesn't spare them the trauma that is an arrest. And I think that this is a fantasy. It's like this idea that, like, we can create this feminist intervention on the police rather than saying, well, why don't we actually look at the projects that sex workers are engaged in, which are harm reduction and outreach projects, which are peer-based education projects, which don't require any kind of relationship with the police, except insofar as the police harass them. You know, I've heard numerous stories across the U.S. of harm reduction projects where, you know, sex workers are going out in their own communities trying to distribute condoms, safer sex kits, and getting harassed by the police for doing this. And it's like, wait a minute, why are you doing this? Why are you going around, you know, you say you want to protect these people, and yet now you're removing one of their means by which they're protecting themselves. I think what they say is they want to be the protectors. The police still want the job of controlling the industry. And this, you know, idea that we can treat them as victims now versus criminals, like, I think it's purely linguistic when you look at the reality of who's still going to jail.
And finally, you've got a passage toward the end of the book about solidarity. And so what do sex workers want from people who are not sex workers, who are sympathetic to their cause? How does one demonstrate or exercise solidarity?
I'm glad you framed it around solidarity and not policy recommendations, because I'm so often asked, like, well, the legal system's screwed up, so what should we be doing differently? And I always back it all the way up to this question of solidarity and mutual aid and, you know, really being committed to listening to sex workers' own demands and to moving resources and power into their own hands to take control over the conditions of their own lives and their own labor. And that's going to require people to depart from this rescue mentality. And it's going to require people to depart from looking at the police as the primary social figure who, you know, is between the rest of us and sex workers. It's going to require people to understand that, you know, sex work is actually a labor and human rights concern and not a criminal legal issue. And more than anything, I think the biggest stretch is it's going to require them to view sex workers as political actors, as people who have agency and control in their lives. Fully human people with actual demands that need to be met, and that the demands of their lives aren't just restricted to the commercial sexual transactions that they engage in. Which, you know, one of the characters that I refer to in the book, or the phenomenons I refer to in the book, is this idea of the prostitute imaginary, this idea that, you know, a sex worker is fully defined by the sexual interaction she has at work. And I think that it creates such a barrier to understanding sex workers as people with political power, and as people who, you know, they've got this. Like, they don't necessarily need people outside sex work to come in and intervene, but they do need people who are making sex workers' lives more difficult to get out of the way.
That was Melissa Jira Grant, a journalist and former sex worker whose new book, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, is just out under the Jacobin imprint from Verso. You can see her in San Francisco on March 19th at the Booksmith, 1644 Haight Street, 7:30 p.m. March 19th, 7:30 at the Booksmith on Haight. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from the fourth movement of Haydn's String Quartet No. 64, performed by the Kodály Quartet. Till next week, bye.